Hi, everybody. Welcome virtually to the MIT Media Lab. I'm Joe Paradiso, as you heard, a professor here, where I run the Responsive Environments Group. I'm going to talk about the ways in which we're going to be connecting more and more to this digital infrastructure that's around us, aided increasingly by AI and processes like this. I'll give you a bit of an introduction to where I think it's all going, and then I'll delve into some projects for my group. And then I'll go through a bunch of conclusions about where this all could be heading. So first, a little bit about the kind of research I do here at the Media Lab. I look at how people connect to sensors at different scales. We build lots of embedded sensor platforms, deploy them at various places in various ways. We're very well known for our work in wearable sensing, been doing that for decades. We've done a lot of work in smart building sensors, connecting buildings to people in different ways through virtual worlds. We're doing the same thing for environmental sensing and landscapes, and now we've been doing projects in space. That little robot there on the top middle actually is sitting on the moon right now. Unfortunately, deployed in IM-2, so it fell over, but it is there. This is a picture of my grandparents. Italian immigrants came in the beginning of the century, came here like so many others to build a better life. And just think of the kinds of things that their generation saw. They remember when they were kids, trolleys pulled by horses, for example, right? Horse and buggies. But they lived to see the moon landing. They lived to see a different kind of buggy moving on the moon. That's a profound transformation just in the course of one lifetime. This is me, my generation, right? As a kid, I grew up with the beginning of computers. That's me going with my dad to a big IBM, I think it was a 3070 computer installation, or 7030. And to the right, you see me just some years ago wearing a now obsolete version of Magic Leap, having much more than the computation power in that whole building just in my pocket. So the way computation has moved closer to people, has transformed individual lives at every level, has been profound, maybe not quite profound as going from horse and buggy to a moon landing. But what is this generation going to see? They're going to see, I think, in many ways, the transformation of humans, of identity, of cognition, mediated through all this infrastructure that my generation has seen really start to deploy. And of course, this is the thing that's on all of our mind now. We have AI now. This is Norbert Wiener, famous character in cybernetics, real pioneer in these kinds of things here at MIT, real legendary character in many ways. Talking about this already in one of Boston's more sensational papers back in the day. So, people were worried about it. Norbert was off a little bit. But we like to see this instead now, right? Now that we have machines that can think in different ways, if you want to call it that, we don't see it replacing people, but rather extending people. How can we develop human AI systems that will enable us to do more than what we can do as individuals? So this is one place that we've been doing some projects in this space. This is Jordan Rudess. Some of you may know him. He's one of the best keyboard players on the planet. He is the keyboardist of the famous band Dream Theater. But whenever you want to show a keyboard virtuoso in rock, Jordan is kind of the go-to person. Jordan is fascinated with technology, loves AI, and we got to know him over the last years and started a collaboration with him to look at how AI can augment skilled musicianship, not replace musicians, but enable them to do in live performance more than what they could normally do, even a musician as talented as Jordan is. And I think in many ways, music is really at the edge of this whole frontier of human-computer interaction, where you have an intimate real-time interaction between a human and a machine in a performance that has to work at many, many levels. So it's a great way to explore concepts that I think have much broader applicability. So we built a model, an AI model of Jordan's playing using a transformer model, essentially like what people do in large language models, but using musical phrases as opposed to text. And we had Jordan play in many different styles, built a few different models of that. And then we enabled him to leverage that in performance. So he could play off of a musical brain of his, basically, that could anticipate what he was doing in different ways. So here's Jordan in a live performance we had about a year ago here at MIT. He's doing his wonderful style of playing, giving input to the AI while he's playing. AI responds. And you can see the thing in the back is moving in a way to suggest what the AI may be doing. It's a whole other frontier. Jordan plays again, kind of pushes somewhere else. AI is putting off what he did, bringing it in a different direction. Jordan kind of brings it home here. So this is, again, an intimate interaction between a skilled virtuoso and an AI model trained on what he can do. What happens if you don't have the virtuoso playing with his own model, but you have someone that doesn't play nearly as well, and just someone like me? I can play some keyboard. I'm far away from Jordan Rudess, but now I have the master at my disposal. And in this model, it would listen to the notes I play, and when I pause, it plays what Jordan's model thinks is the best chord. Again, trained on Jordan giving input. So here I am, you know, playing at my limited ability, but I've got one of the best in the business kind of reaching over my shoulder and augmenting what I'm doing. And I didn't want to stop this. This was at the NAMM show last year. We had a special demo suite, and Jordan was bringing other people in to see it, but I had to keep going. So again, it hints at where this can go. But of course, you don't have to be alive to have this kind of augmentation in a way. Marvin Minsky is one of the pioneers of AI. Colleague of ours here at the Media Lab, passed away really before you saw the large language models and AI starting to come into prominence a few years ago. So he never saw it, but he was an avid pianist, and his family gave us many recordings of him playing the piano. He would improvise fugues. So this is an example of one. So we trained up a model on Marvin, and here he is playing a player piano. So this is Xiao Xiao, a researcher that collaborates with us on this. So that's Marvin playing, Marvin's model, not Marvin in real time. This is something Marvin never played, but it's honed on his playing. And Xiao can answer it. And then the spirit of Marvin responds. So this has lots of implication, right? We're all just trying to figure out what it is. Here's some examples. It's certainly has tremendous possibilities for pedagogy. You have the hand of the master, as I showed before. You can have models actually train players to improve their technique. It's a new concept of sampling. Musicians always ask, oh, can we sample some of this? This technology doesn't sample the audio. It samples the style of the artist and captures their zeitgeist, so to speak, right? Not their bits. So then you can start to paint a track by the virtual artist over your own piece that adapts to what you compose. You use it for extended live performance like we have. Ideally, there's a royalty share that comes to the artist who contributed to the model. We're talking with other people around here at MIT and with Jordan on ways to do that as it moves forward. And of course, eventually you can rip this from the recordings as we showed from Marvin. So this is just a very fast moving road. We're exploring ways of adding expression modulation to the model, improving and extending it, ways to accommodate and incarnate the AI's contribution and intent visually for the audience and performers as well. That's the whole thing. How do you manifest the AI on stage? Another place we've worked out in the group is buildings is what we call prosthetics, extensions of people, right? So buildings ideally serve many functions, but they want to keep you comfortable and productive. Can we start tapping into how humans react to have that be kind of an automatic extension? This is a project we did years ago, 2009. It was a wearable that measured lots of things, including temperature, humidity, where you were, how you were moving. But you could label it with those buttons on the side if you were hot or cold. It was long before we had smartwatches. And it would build a model of your comfort. And this is really interesting to us. It's not just to sense what you're doing, but to sense something that's intangible, like comfort, right? So we built a model of each individual so we could ground a comfort that comfort model with sensor data and then control the HVAC by whether you were comfortable or not and still try to save energy. We went further, though, and had whole rooms transformed. We had lighting change according to what you wanted to see, what you were doing, context-based models, but we also could transform a whole room to take you somewhere else based on how you were responding to it. We had sensors that you'd wear, the cameras that looked at you, looked at how you responded, the room would change. And the idea is to keep you focused and restore, so you're relaxed and you're in control. So here's an example, a scenario, someone has time on their hands at work, so they're, just kind of doing leisurely activities here, but work comes in, emergencies break down, things break down, emergencies come up, and colleague comes in with even more work. So the sensors detect stress, and they transform the room to bring the occupant into a state that's more restorative. For him, it happens to be the woodland setting. He feels more in control, starts engaging with work, the sensors pick that up,
and go to a space where he's better suited to flow, which in this case is a library setting. In this case, the sensors were recording the features. We could classify it in that affect space, and we could transform the room.
That wasn't closed loop. That was mocked up. This is closed loop, so it's actually working here. You can see the sensor data. On the right, you can see the state, and we're trying to get her state up in the upper right quadrant. We're changing the image and reweighting the images as it adapts and learns. And we built wearables to try to sense things that are intriguing for that. And as we start getting into these intimate interfaces, sensors not only look out, but actually look inward, try to gauge your cognitive load, your affective state, so that interfaces can moderate themselves to be more amenable to what you do to focus your attention. I think these are more and more important. And the Captivates glasses that we had a whole variety of sensors, including thermal sensors around the glasses to look at blood flow differences across the head. Those are related to cognitive load and other things. So we have other sensors, eye blinks, how you move your head, things like this to try to do this. And we're also looking at incorporating environmental sensors. You can actually measure the air you breathe right above the nose, so you can see how buildings affect your performance as well, because you're measuring the air quality, for instance, in the building. You're measuring these other parameters and seeing internally how you start to react to it. So we've done many studies with collaborators all over the world on things like how buildings affect people's performance. Also, the world is going to push back on us in many other ways. This is another project we're looking at. It distributed actuation around the body. In this case, it's a distributed haptic system. These things can vibrate in different ways. You can program different kinds of haptic scenarios. We're looking at something that isn't entirely physical, like a drone swarm. How do you connect people to something like this so they can actually feel it, right? If the drones are going to be hitting an edge of a wall or something like that, you can feel it in the right part of your body. You can feel it if they're going to constrict, if they're coming out, or if there's a different kind of a threat to the system, if there's something they notice. You can feel it across your body spatially, not just see it visually, which can be very effective in, again, improving human performance. It's a collaboration with a drone group at APFL, haptics experts in Toronto, and my student here, Sam, at MIT. This is the last thing I'm going to talk about. It's intriguing to think about how you connect to all this information when there are sensors covering the world that are networked. Can you start thinking about how it changes the feeling of the here and now, how it really affects our sense of place? We wrote an article in Scientific American about it. I was just in San Diego a couple of years ago giving a colloquium for the computer science department at SDSU, home of Werner Vinge, professor there, one of the real visionaries in speculative fiction, science fiction. He wrote the novels that really paved the road to give a feeling to what this world would be like, where you could begin to play with perception this way through networks. Very influential on me and people like me that work in the field. This is one of the main places where we tested it. We have many test beds for these ideas in my group, but this is a cranberry farm that's just south of Boston in Plymouth. And one of my retired faculty colleagues co-owns it and turned it into a beautiful wetland preserve. And we built sensors to monitor that process and see what happened in the wetland afterward. Lots of sensors in the soil, but lots of other sensors there were good at making these. We made over 200 of them, put them in different kinds of conditions. We worked with wetland hydrologists to see what was happening with rainfall and different kinds of thermal events on the property. So we did some scientific work with it. But for me, the amazing thing is using these systems to explore being virtually somewhere else. So I can virtually visit a model of the wetland with real-time data from our sensor network tunneling in, both as visuals and, for instance, here is music. So the music you're hearing is driven in real time by the sensors. Every time one updates, you hear a little pluck. The timbre and the pitch related to temperature and humidity. And of course, it's a virtual world. You can walk around and explore it. The animals that are there eat the sensor data, so to speak, and change their appearance according to the history of certain kinds of parameters. This is another musical mapping, much more spatialized. And you can hear the different conditions as you approach to the different sensors. Totally different way for the sensor information to come up and touch people. And you ask the question as well, perhaps, what happens if you're physically there? Can you start augmenting your perception? And we thought about doing AR glasses and so on. Lots of people are doing that. We didn't want to get in the way of what you see in here, though. We went for bone conduction audio. So it doesn't cover the ear. It adds information. We have microphones all over the place. We know where you are with GPS on your phone. We could detect where your head was by an IMU that we had on the sensor. So we could have the sounds come up from the microphones as if your ears were way out in the marsh, right? You could, you're expanded by this. This is one wearable I built that I never wanted to take off. We had many people try it. This is Dan Gager, distinguished scientist at Bose at the time, designed most of their earbuds and headphones. This is something he had never experienced before.
As I move my head,
this is a naturalist we work with.
The tree birds. And now I'm hearing more ducks and geese and froggy frog. And I put on my supersonic.
This is a way we could focus the perception to look just ahead of you.
And now that's really all I'm getting.
So I'm fascinated with these interfaces that bring reality closer to us that don't abstract it away. And I think there's new experience, new ways of interacting with the world that are really nascent there. So it's an exciting time to be alive. Despite the problems of our current day, the things we're seeing are just incredible. We're at the edge of a new era in many ways. We have now true AI. I remember talking to Marvin Minsky, asking him when does he think AI was going to be a few years before he passed. He was saying 2030 something. For once, he was pessimistic, right? Already, we've been living in this world a few years and we've seen nothing yet. So we're going to have lots of revolutions in materials, modalities, capabilities, understanding and knowledge. I'm firmly believing in that. Our systems are going to extend from outer space to deep in nature and in on our bodies, and that information is going to come together and come to us. I think the big question, of course, is what is the human going to become as everything merges? Very topical, I think, for the symposium. I wrote at the dawn of Internet of Things. I was one of the early players in Internet of Things. I did a lot of work in that area, and I wrote an article about an interactive balloon, and I wrote in the abstract that life in a world saturated with these capabilities would be very different from this phase we're entering now, back in 1996. Yeah, it's different, but I still feel the same. So it's easy to say it's going to be transformed. And after we look back, it was, but it wasn't. I think it will be transformed. So it's going to be a different world. I think one of AI's tasks as it integrates with us more and more will be to keep us busy, right? Teach us to be able to function without it. The great novel by Charles Strauss, Accelerando, there was a part where the protagonist lost his smart glasses. He had more or less plasticized to it, so he couldn't function without them. I think part of AI is going to be teaching us to work without these prosthetics, right? It will work with us to make us better, even without the AI. And of course, you have the doomsayers that say AI will take over, will destroy us. It's the apocalyptic scenario of murderous AI. I think that doesn't make so much sense. I tend to agree with James Lovelock in that great book he wrote before he passed, Novocaine. It's counterproductive to be destructive. If it wants to supersede us, the best way to do it is to make us basically happy and make us busy and content, because populations in developed countries that are like this tend to naturally go down. I'm speaking outside of my area here. I don't want to make any issues, but I don't think destructive AI is, even in the worst scenario, what we necessarily have to be afraid of. Although we have to keep it in mind, we don't know, but there are other avenues here, maybe some that aren't so bad. One other thing about this network world that we're living in, we thought that we're living in something like a group mind now, right? I've got this phone here that is transforming my and everybody's lives by being at arm's length. And we have the wearable, it will be even more influential in so many ways. And I believe it will come. But instead of everybody kind of marching to the same drummer as we were afraid of with Uniminds, like the Borg and people that watch the series Pluribus now, right? That's not what we got. What we got is a schizophrenic mind, right? It's so easy for this network to hallucinate. And, you know, in humans that have, you know, hallucinations, so on and so forth, and schizophrenia, inhibitory neural functions aren't damping them out. They're not converging to one unified grasp of reality. The net is doing the same thing. It is basically self-reinforcing on these things that are hallucinations and seeing them as reality. So the group mind is schizophrenic. It's one of the big problems we have. How do you fix it? With patients in the physical world, you give them neurosuppressants. In the network world, we have censorship, ideally mediation. We want to try to find something that will keep it creative and vibrant without an iron glove. And I think this is really crucial as we go forward. And I believe AI will probably play a big role, hopefully, in eliminating this. And finally, in this world, eventually, if you look as far as we can go, right, we wire into the computer, it becomes part of our awareness. These things are coming. I think they're still a little far out. Plenty is going to happen en route, even if you accept this as one of the endpoints. Again, I'm intrigued in ways we can connect people in a more full way to physical reality, like I showed in that last example with the bone conduction headphones. Are there ways to open us up in many ways, really have a richer experience of reality, not one that's diminished? What are the new interfaces that connect us to this? And how do they scale? This is a big issue, I think, scaling these interfaces between immersion and peripheral awareness. You know, what things are poking at us, what things are going to be pulling us in. And finally, where does self stop and where does other begin? I think these technologies that connect us and mediate us really start playing with the nature of identity at every level. And I think this is one of the most poignant issues of our time. Where is this going to go? Thank you very much for your patience, and I look forward to the Q&A.